This episode of the Deck Tees Podcast is brought to you by Gathering Magic and CoolStuffInc.com. Become a part of their customer rewards program when you make any purchase and receive discounts on all future orders. That is CoolStuffInc.com. Hello and welcome to episode 118 of the Deck Tees Podcast. I am your host, Erin Campbell. My guest today is one of the top 25 Magic players in the whole world. He's also a member of the Pro Tour Hall of Fame, who writes for TCG Player in his spare time. He is Raphael Levy. Hello.
Hi, how are you?
I am great. Thank you so much for joining me today.
It's my pleasure.
Yeah, and you are coming to me from South Africa, is that right?
I'm currently in South Africa, yes,
okay,
close to Johannesburg.
Okay, but you're from France.
I'm from France. I live in France, but I am currently in South Africa.
Okay, what's in South Africa?
My parents-in-law. My wife is from here, and we are visiting for the holidays.
Interesting. And how is South Africa?
Now it's pretty warm. I'm pretty sure all you guys are like freezing and in coats and stuff, and I'm just having a tan. We just got back from the beach, so we spent a few days at the beach. That was great.
Oh man, it is so cold here. I don't know, like, how. I'm pretty sure we're the only. It's below zero right now, and it is so cold actually that the company I work for is allowing us to wear jeans because they understand that dress clothes don't really keep you warm.
So that's we don't need jeans here.
Yeah. So that's how bad it is right now, is I have to wear jeans, not out of vanity or anything, but because they will keep me more warm than my normal dress clothes will. So.
Oh, no, here it's lovely. It's not actually too warm. It's not above 30 degrees. It's about like 20, 25. Ugh. And yeah, it's lovely here.
Oh, you just rub it in, Raph. Rub it in.
Yeah, I can go on for a while if you want.
No, I'm already just pulling up my sweater and tightening the strings, and I'm freezing as I talk to you.
Yeah, but don't be jealous. I'll be back to winter in a couple of days. So
okay.
I'll be just as miserable as you guys are.
Well, you're certainly making it a lot more manageable. So let's go ahead and get started. So you grew up in Toulouse, France.
Yes.
Okay. What was that like?
What was that like? Just. A normal childhood, you know, just going to school and just like every like normal kid, nothing special, mm-hmm. like up to like in the growing up part.
Mm-hmm. I've noticed that a lot of your doings in the Magic community revolve around France. Like, you've been on the world team. You know, it seems like it's very important for you to represent French Magic well. Is that true?
Well. Since I started in France, I actually played in another country for the team. Not for a team. I played in nationals in another country. Mm-hmm. I played in Sweden for I played Swedish nationals in 2006.
Okay,
which it was just was a test try. I didn't make the team, but it was fun. But yeah, it feels like France has been around for a while. It's been successful, and sometimes less successful, sometimes infamous. And it feels like I have this responsibility to, you know, make our country shine. Mm-hmm. It's not too much of a patriotism. It's just, you know, I'm from there and I like the people from there and I need to represent the country somehow.
Mm-hmm. Now, were you living in Sweden at the time that you were trying out for the team? Like, what was going on there?
Yeah, I was living in Sweden. Like, basically what happened was I grew up in France. I lived for a very long time in France, even though I was traveling around for Magic. I lived almost a year in Israel.
Wow.
After a failed first year at university, I was starting to study math and computers. It was just like way too hard for what I was for how much I was working. Mm-hmm. I was playing Magic and I was trying to do everything at the same time. It was just not working out. Mm-hmm. So I needed to take a break. So I left to Israel for a year just to, you know, find myself a little bit. I got home, went to university again to study languages. and spent 4 years there in France. And after that, I just need another break. I need to go somewhere else. I need to find myself again. So I left to another country, brand new start, Sweden, and I wasn't supposed to come back, but well, I did come back to France for some personal reasons.
Speaking of languages, I just have to say you have one of the most beautiful accents I've ever heard. So if you feel the need to just start speaking French, I am very okay with that.
No, but I can speak in French English if you want.
French English, what is that?
Oh, it's just the French accent, but it would sound a little less good for you.
So it's like you're embellishing almost.
No, I like speaking English the way I speak it normally, like now.
Okay, I'm very okay with it either way. So just keep on talking.
It doesn't sound true. I don't like the French accent. I just make it to make fun of the English speaking French people.
The people who are more French than you.
More French than me, yeah. Well, we haven't had the chance to actually learn how to speak English and too well or travel. You know, I'm very lucky to have been able to, you know, travel around and learn the language and be able to speak my English right now.
Mm-hmm. So what were your school years like? Like, what were you into as a kid? Were you into sports? Were you into debate? Any nerdy pursuits?
So when I was a kid, like when I was five, I got a little sick. I got like an operation, and from then on, like, it was just my appendix just mm-hmm. burst, and I was pretty bad.
Whoa!
And from then on, like, I was not really into sports because, you know, my parents were like, yeah, well, he can't do this because he's very fragile, and so it kind of kept me away from all the sports activities. So, you know, when you're a kid and you can't do sports, you do some other stuff. And I was playing more chess than soccer. Mm-hmm. Like when all the kids were playing soccer, I was busy in the classroom playing chess. So not really a sport addict in my first years. Mm-hmm.
I'm sorry. So were you okay with that? Or were you somebody who, you know, would you watch your peers play and think, man, I really wish I could do that?
No, not really. Okay. I didn't really care. I was happy doing my stuff.
Okay. And when did you first discover magic?
So it was when I was, 12 or 13? Mm-hmm. That was in 95, right? Yeah, I think it was 95, so I was 13. Mm-hmm. So it was, yeah, you know, like, I was very competitive when I was playing chess. I loved, like, playing against, like, older people and beating them. That was really my kicks. So when I discovered magic and I said, oh, yeah, that could be fun. And then I started to learn the rules and like teenagers already, like 17, like 16, 17 year old people, and I was feeling great about it. And then I played some more tournaments, and I loved it. So that's pretty much how I went to from fun magic to competitive magic.
Mm-hmm. Now, did somebody introduce you to the game, or did you just pick up a pack and teach yourself?
Now, a friend of mine who was really, like, who was into, like, all this kind of new games and introduced me to the game. And I was just, like, playing at home first with home rules, like, pretty stupid rules that didn't really make sense. Mm-hmm. And then I thought, yeah, well, we have to know how to actually play this game because it looks cool. Mm-hmm. And so we went to this, like, close to my place, about 5 minutes away, walking. There was this game center. It was not exactly the game center you have now. Mm-hmm. It was more of like a place where you have video games.
Sure, like an arcade. Like
not arcades, because arcades were like for grown ups already.
Oh,
like you don't when you're 12, like back in 94 or 95, arcades were not really a nice place to hang out when you're only 12. It's like, you know, there's money involved and you know, bigger kids would just like bully the little ones, and if you have money in your pocket, it's not a good idea.
And that's so interesting. That's so interesting, because I remember being a kid and going to the arcade, and I used to play the Mortal Kombat games, and I would take my babysitting money and I would feed it into the change machine to get quarters, and I spent a lot of time at the arcade at that age. That's so interesting. Well,
I like that too, but you needed to go there with someone a little older. Like if you're 12 or 13, I loved Street Fighter 2 and Mortal Kombat. I loved to play Killer Instinct right after.
Mm.
But to go there, you need to like
be able to, you know, not being bullied around. Mm-hmm. Because that's sometimes you had like bad encounters and, you know, that's, oh, well, that's another story, but, no, the video game, the place we went, it's just that had the consoles and the board games, like Super Nintendo's, Mega Drive, and, there was a Neo Geo as well.
I remember Neo Geo.
That was cool. Like, that was the big thing of the big thing of the room. And then you had the PCs as well. And they were playing, what was it? That was Doom 1, I think.
Yeah.
They had four computers, in LAN, and they were playing Doom 1 and some other games. So that was where we were hanging out. That was where we actually learned how to play Magic. That was called Liberty Games. Mm-hmm. That was very, very cool times.
Is Liberty Games still around?
No, it's not. It's been closed for a very, very long time. I think I was like 16 mm-hmm. when it closed, like 4 years later.
Okay. I always like hearing stories from people where the stores that got them started are still around. That always makes me feel really good.
But that was the game, the store that was selling the cards still around.
Okay. So it sounds like you went into Magic knowing that you wanted to be competitive. You didn't just go into it saying, this is a game I'm going to putz around with for a little while. That sounds like you knew what you wanted to do.
Like, all my friends were also very competitive. So when it came to, like, when we first got a chance to play tournaments, because in the beginning there were no tournaments.
Yeah.
There was, like, one tournament once in a while. That was the big thing. Mm-hmm. We had, like, maybe, like, 40 or 50 players. Back in the days, it was, like, a big tournament. And if it was preparing like crazy, it was very, very very interesting back then. I loved it.
Yeah.
And that's probably when I started really to love it, to love the competition. Mm-hmm. And then we had the regionals. I qualified for my for my first nationals playing regionals. And the story is pretty cool because I played it. I was, how old was I? Maybe 15? Yeah, I was 15 back then. 14 or 15. And only the top 8 would qualify. Mm-hmm. And I did not make the top 8. I think I was like maybe 10s or 12s. But they had a slot for the first junior. And junior was people with 16 or less.
Yeah.
And I was tied with another kid. But it was... He was the system was a little different. We had we didn't have computer system. It was only I don't know if you remember if you were playing back then. It was paper sheets,
result sheets,
and you counted up your points, and at the end you would give it back to a judge. And that was another system. Anyway, I was tied with another kid, and the organizer said, "Oh, this other kid is qualified." I'm like, "Wait a second, I'm just as old as he is, and I have the same number of points." And he said, okay, so let's play a tiebreaker match. Oh, sweet. And I won that match, qualified for my first nationals. That was in 96. 96, I was 15.
Very nice. Did your parents support you playing at that age?
Yeah, well, there was nothing wrong.
Yeah.
Nothing wrong about it. And I was actually 14. Okay. There was nothing wrong about it. That was just like a healthy activity.
Okay. Well, I know some parents have the attitude of, you know, where is this going? You're spending too much time with this. Maybe it's distracting you from your studies.
Well, I was doing fine at school, so I didn't really have – as long as I was doing fine at school, there was no problem with it.
Okay.
You know, if you do fine, there's no reason for the parents to be worried.
And you made your first Pro Tour appearance in Paris when you were 16.
I was actually 15.
15.
It was '97.
Wow, 15 years old, what was that like?
That was, you know, like back then, since we were all very competitive, and I was only 15, and the Pro Tour was something like very big. Mm-hmm. And I didn't get the chance to prepare really to the PT. Mm-hmm. Like all my friends were kind of, yeah, well, he qualified, now he's bragging a lot about it. I was probably bragging a lot about it. I mean, I qualified for the PT, and I just like brought a random deck I built and I tried to improve, but that was not really Pro Tour level. Mm-hmm. But that was the start of something. Mm-hmm. When I played the PT, I thought, yeah, I'm not really prepared for that. And I know I could be prepared for that, but not just yet. Mm-hmm. That was a fun experience. That was only in Paris. So that wasn't really too far away.
Mm-hmm. So when it was over with, did you leave feeling like you could hang? Like I can be one of these people. Like I'm as good as these people, or I could be.
Not yet, because qualifying was so hard. Like it was not then. It was just a little after. And I was probably not really aware of what I could do. So after I finished that Pro Tour, I was like, yeah, well, I had a 3-3 result. I think it was only 6 rounds. I was like, yeah, well, 3-3 is not very good, but you know, it's my first PT. At that time, I didn't think it was my first PT. It was just the PT. I didn't know there was gonna be more after that.
So you didn't think you'd make it back?
Oh, I didn't think about it. I don't think I would not. It just was not really a thing then. I didn't think I would be like, okay, like I'm gonna play Magic a lot now, and I'm gonna do everything I need to qualify. We would play all the qualifiers, but it's not like, you know, you play to win, but the expectations are not as high. Well, not as high as they could be now for someone who actually wants to play competitive Magic.
So how does that compare? You mentioned that it was difficult qualifying back then. How is it now compared to then? Like, would you say it's easier? It's gotten easier?
I have no idea. Like
No.
I haven't played. No, I played the. I don't know. It's hard to say because I played the PTQ for what was it? Atlanta
Okay.
or Portland? No, I played a PTQ for Portland when I didn't have my ticket. Oh, that's right, for Portland. I played the one PTQ in like 10 years and I won it. So I don't know exactly how it's very. It really depends on a lot of things. I don't know. Now with the new PPTQ system, I have no idea how it is. I don't even know how it works exactly. So I can't really say if it's harder or. I guess if you just know how to play the game and if you're really good, you qualify. You'll qualify eventually. You'll see all these people like Paul Chian. I just saw he won a PTQ like last weekend or something. Oh, no, he made top 8 at the GP. So he qualified for the next PT. This guy is very good. So it's very normal he gets back on the Pro Tour, and he played in Honolulu as well. So if you're good, you'll make it. That's
I was very happy about Paul. Like I said, I got the chance to play with Paul at the Community Cup this year, and he's a very lovely guy, beautiful family. He's been working very hard, and I'm really glad that he's back on the trings. I know that he really wants it. I know that him and LSV are very close, and LSV. I had LSV on my show this year, and he had said something to the effect of, that Paul Chian makes the Pro Tours fun for him. So it's really nice to see that pairing back together again, and I just couldn't be happier for him.
Now, I have him in mind because I just read his tweet like a couple of days ago. Like, oh yeah, I'm so happy to be back on the Pro Tour. And, oh yeah, wasn't he back already? Oh yeah, okay, he was already back.
And then after the Pro Tour in Paris, I read that you missed one Pro Tour in New York, but then since then you haven't missed a Pro Tour?
I think actually you missed three.
Okay.
So I missed right after Paris. There was New York, the one I think it was Thierry Bohrer who won that one. It was in fifth edition Vision. This one I missed. I played Word after that. Then I missed the one Randy Buehler one, and the one Finkel one. So three PTs. And yes, and I qualified for Worlds 98 through Nationals. And since then, I didn't miss a PT. That was in August 98.
And what is it that keeps you interested after all this time? Like you're still going, you're still chugging along?
Well, you know, traveling has been quite a routine now. I want to travel. I need to travel. When I'm home for too long, I feel like I have to go away again. And every time I felt, you know, down, it felt like I didn't want to play anymore. I thought, yeah, that would be too bad just to quit now. You know, even if I don't want to go, I'm still qualified, so I just go and see how I do. And we'll see for the next time, for the next PT. And every time I just went back, and someday I feel more motivated than others. Like over the last, I don't know how long it was, like 15 years, a bit more probably.
What do
Yeah,
you
now it's going
find
to be 17 years.
motivates you more than anything? Like you said that sometimes you're feeling it and sometimes you're not. What leads you to be more interested in going and what makes you not so sure you want to go back?
I think it's just like a momentary thing. Like when I don't feel like going, it's just like, oh, I'm just tired. I haven't had a good week or a good month, or That's when I don't want to go, but otherwise I always want to go. It's the competition. It's just the thrill of the PT tables. I really like that. Mm-hmm. And over the years, it's never really went away.
Are there certain formats that you enjoy more than others? Like if you hear that a pro tour is going to be maybe modern, you're more likely to go or you're more excited to go?
It's actually the other way around. If it's modern, I don't really feel like going.
You don't like modern?
Oh, I hate it.
Oh, I love modern.
Oh, well, but that's another story. I'm not really a big fan of modern. But
you've got to tell me the story because I love modern.
It's just like I haven't been very successful. I just don't understand how it works. It's really? Very frustrating when there's a format when you don't really do well in and you don't really see why. Mm-hmm. You know, I've been I think I played over all the tournaments I played modern, I'm probably less than 50%. How do you say it? How would I say that? In more than half my tournaments, I didn't win half my games. Does that make sense?
Sure.
Something like that. Yeah. So it's very, very frustrating. Mm-hmm. And I have to break that at some point. Probably next PT. Hopefully that's gonna be next. I say that all the time, but hopefully next PT is gonna change.
So you prefer standard or sealed then?
I prefer limited, yes.
Yeah.
Well, just when we play before the tournament and we can't find a deck we like, we feel like, oh no, this tournament is gonna be miserable. And then in the last few days we find something we like and we feel excited. That happened in the last few tournaments. And what was the last standard? Was it Portland? Yeah, Portland. We felt miserable, and then we found the mana red, the rebel red deck. Mm-hmm. And then we all felt really excited. I felt really excited about it.
Yeah.
So,
do you enjoy the prep side of things, where you go to the pro tour like a week or two early, and you get to stay in a house or an apartment with your team, and you get to bond with them and do all of that? Do you enjoy that aspect?
Yes and no. Yes, because it could be a lot of fun. Sometimes when you have the right lineup with all the people you like, and that's really cool, and I really enjoy that. And there's one part that's really tough is the stress that comes along with it. It's part of the game, but it's very, very stressful. Mm-hmm. Like one day it pretty much follows the same pattern every time. You get to the preparation, you either feel excited because you have a deck in your pocket, you say, okay, well, I'm ready for this tournament already. We have a week, but I'm just going to tune my deck. And then a day later, you can't win a single game. Like, oh yeah, maybe that's not the right deck. And then you find another deck, you feel excited again. And then, like, a couple of hours later, you can't beat anybody. Mm-hmm. And it's just like a big roller coaster. Like, oh, you're excited, and then you're depressed. Excited, depressed. And then the day or two before the PT, you're very stressed because you don't know where you're at. You're like, okay, well, should I trust this person who worked on this deck for so long and he really think it's the best? Or should I just go with my guts? And this is always very stressful. Mm-hmm. And then you have the extra stress, the cards you sometimes don't have. You're missing like a couple of cards and you don't know if the dealer's going to have it. You don't know who to ask because you don't want to spread the word too much.
Yeah.
So that's part of the stress. It's good and bad. Mm-hmm. I guess overall it's good.
Yeah. Do you enjoy the social aspect, like being in a room with all those people and getting to know them and seeing them time and time again?
I enjoy it to a certain point because staying with people for a week or 10 days with seven people who usually come from very different, places with different, not cultures, but can, habits. Mm-hmm. It could be very, very hard sometimes. You know, you can't spend more than a couple of days with some people, with a lot of people, because, you know, you're going to be some tensions. Sometimes you try to have to keep the tensions as low as possible, but you can't really keep that from happening. Sure. I don't know any group where tensions don't appear. Mm-hmm. And it's good. Again, it's good and bad. It's part of the thing. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, whenever I hear of the pros, you know, getting a house together and testing for the pro tour, I always think of it like The Real World, that show from the MTV. And I always wish that somebody would create like a confessional room where, like, you know, you would see Owen in the confessional and he would be like, Kibler just totally ate my Oreo cookies. And they would just complain to the camera about things that might have happened. And I just imagine it going down like that with, you know, with laughs and tension and weirdness and fun. And, you know, it seems like it'd be a good time, but I can understand where you're coming from too, where you're like, you know,
There
do I
was
have to
something like
spend.
that.
Yeah.
There was something like that happened at some point. That was for PT Osaka 2002, I think. It was, I don't know how it was called. And someplace had a house and they were blogging about it. I think it was supported by Wizards even.
Okay.
I have to look it up because I think it was who was there? I don't remember who was the team back then. That was a couple of American players. No, a few Americans. Probably like 10, sharing a room and blogging about it, and it didn't go too well, so the experience was not renewed. But it was not on TV. But that could be a thing.
Yeah, I keep thinking that's something Walking the Plane should do. You know, they always do those neat little skits of things, and I was like, that'd be
Oh, that
really
could be
cool.
fun. That
Yeah, that
could be
could be.
fun.
So you've been playing Magic for about competitive Magic for about 20 years now. Which achievements or moments are you most proud of? Like when you look back at your career, when you look back at all the GPs and all the pro tours you've been to, is there a particular one that you really enjoyed the most or that really stood out to you?
Pretty much every time you win, that's something you remember.
Yeah.
Like second place is always not like you if you remember second place, it's because it's something that's still painful to think of, to remember. Yeah, there are a couple of proud moments. Like the first GP, the first time I won a GP was in Lyon in '98, so I was 16 back then. And you know, that was this kid, like no one at this time you had a few famous French players, and they were like maybe four or five. They went to Pro Tour New York, the first Pro Tour New York, the one you have with the collectible decks. You see which ones I mean?
I think so.
The first gold bordered cards.
Yes.
Right, so some players played that, and they were like the big French superstars. And then you had a few other players who played the PT, who already played the PT, and you were only hearing about them. So I was nobody back then. No one knew who I was, and I knew at that point I knew I could do something. So when I won the GP, people were like, yeah, maybe he's good." I remember the French DCI managers, like the French DCI manager and someone else working at Wizards France. They bet on the finals if I could win or not. One of them who knew who I was, the other one didn't. And the one who knew I was like, "I bet whatever you want on him to win." And the other guy was like, "Nah, he's just a French kid. He's never gonna win. Frenchies don't win." And I proved him wrong, and I was very, very proud about it.
Now, when
And
you said that you think back on the like the second place finishes and that it might be a little painful for you, is it that you're thinking of like how you could have done better, like there's that misplay that haunts you kind of
oh
thing?
yeah. Oh
Yeah.
yeah. In 2000, I lost the finals of European Championships. And even talking about it right now is very painful. I play against Noah Boeken from the Netherlands, who now is a big time poker star. But yeah, we played a 5-game match and I could have won like 4-1 and I lost 3-2. I threw away 2 games in the finals, and every time I think of everything I did, I feel so bad. It really, really pains me, like to a point that I couldn't sleep for like 3 months. Like every night, going to every day, going to bed at night, I was like, "Oh, how am I gonna sleep again? How can I forgive myself for doing something that's that bad?" And but yeah, it's over now. I learned how to forgive myself for being bad. No, finish like not focusing enough and stuff. And since then, other stuff happened. So yeah, that's second place, not good.
So I found out something interesting about you, Raphael, when I was researching you. I found that in 2008, you banded together with a handful of other pros and you created something called the MTG Players Union. What was going on at the
Yes.
time that led to that? A union for Magic players?
So that was something. Well, at that time, Wizards made an announcement. They was changing the PT and they was taking out one Pro Tour. So from five a year, we went back to four PTs. And that was at a time when the Pro Players Club was giving appearance fees and pretty much like now, but it was a little different back then. Mm-hmm. But when you, it felt really bad for, like the pro players, we felt like, oh, what's going on? Why didn't they tell us before? So we could have at least like plan what we were doing. Because the year before, a lot of us were traveling around to GPs to get the points to get to another pro level, expecting to get the money from the travel back. Because, you know, you travel and you expect, if you do well, you expect to get your money back for the extra PTs and the appearance fee from the PTs. And then we're told, oh yeah, by the way, there's no PT. And like, okay, so all the efforts we made, like, are not going to be worth what we thought. So we spend all this energy and all this money for something that you control and you're not even telling us about. Mm-hmm. So it felt really bad and we kind of felt like betrayed is a big word, but it's not as bad, but we felt that we could at least give some input in what they're doing. Like they'd never, at that time, they would never ask us what we think of the PT, what we thought of the structures, what we thought of the sets. And the communication was very like one-sided. They would tell us what they were doing and that's it. There was nothing coming back to them. So it was not really to go against them, but more to work with them to improve the Pro Tour, which was, the Pro Tour is like a big display of their brand, their product, and we're a part of it. Mm-hmm. But if you feel treated badly, then it doesn't really feel right.
Yeah.
So since then, like the communication is both, like went both ways. And I really like, I don't know if it was a trigger to make that happen, but every time they want to change something or they don't know, they're not sure about that, they ask us first, like, what do you think if we did that? And that's a very good improvement to the Pro Tour. And maybe we helped doing that, but the initiative was in that way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's definitely something where, you know, I agree with you in that I feel like things have gotten a little better, where I do follow a number of pros on Twitter. And, you know, typically if there's a change that comes down, I know there was some talk about the pro points and how, and I'm probably not entirely clear on this because I'm not a pro, but from what I gather, they because the GP attendance has blown up so much that there was talk about how far down the pro points were awarded and then how many you got. And I could see the discussions happening on Twitter about that. And it does seem like, you know, they have become more receptive where it isn't as one-sided. And you're seeing Helene ask people and you're seeing Scott Larrabee chime in on things. And it does seem like it's gotten a lot better.
Oh, it's much, much better. That would have never happened like 10 years ago. If something was wrong, they're like, oh yeah, that's what's written on the paper. You can't change it. Or maybe next year, but you know, we'll work on that. And they would not really get our feedback too much. But now it's just much, much better. I really like how it's going now.
Do you think that part of the reason why it might have improved is that you all are so much more visible now, where like you do have these forums like Twitter and Facebook and you know, YouTube, and we, you know, we've seen pros call out injustices before, where, you know, obviously MTGO is a big deal and LSV, you know, will call it out, and Kibler certainly calls it out, and if things aren't necessarily going well, you guys can let people know. It's not something they can keep quiet, you know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm. Well, it was part of the same, it was in the same time frame. Like 2008 was the explosion of Facebook and all this all the social networks. Like Twitter wasn't there back then. Oh, I don't remember Twitter back then. I know Facebook was Facebook was starting. People were starting to use Facebook back then. Mm-hmm. So yeah, it's probably at the same time. I don't know what Facebook probably has more influence than with it, but. Yeah, well, it's probably like that, yeah.
Mm-hmm. It just seems easier now where you can really rally the troops or you can point to something. Like, let's say somebody is saying something on Twitter you don't agree with. You can be like, did you see that? Did you see what they just said? And then, you know, your followers can see that. Oh, why are you treating pro players this way? And then, you know, it can become more of a kerfuffle. So.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that same year, you put out an interesting call to your fellow Magic players, encouraging them to suit up at Pro Tour Berlin in the hopes of improving the image of the game. And you were trying to, you were telling people to, you know, dress a little nicer, maybe comb your hair and all that stuff. And where do you feel that the game and the players are at in terms of that now? Like, do you feel that we still have a bit of an image problem?
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, that was a one-time thing. Maybe we can do it again some other time, but you know, when you talk about Magic to other people, like, what do you do in life? Oh yeah, I play Magic. Oh yeah, that's this Pokemon role playing game thingy. Like, well, that's the answer people give. That's the Pokemon role playing game. That's everybody says about Magic. And well, first of all, the name Magic is pretty misleading as like in the first place. But well, that's what it is, so we just keep it. But it doesn't have a good image to the public, to the people who don't know about the game. People who know the game, like, oh yeah, that's the game I played when I was 15. Yeah, that's the game. That's the same one. So showing an image of, like professional people who know, who, come to a tournament, it's their job. They're gonna dress well. They're gonna take it seriously and not be just some teens playing, like a Pokemon game. So it felt important back then. It probably still is, but it's pretty hard to motivate everyone to do it. I don't know. Have you seen the picture of like everyone? Not everyone was. How many were we dressed up? 120 players, maybe a third of the PT. Mm-hmm. There's a really nice pictures on the stairs in Berlin.
Yeah.
With everyone in suits, and that was very cool. Hopefully, we can do that again sometime.
Well, I'm all for men in suits. I definitely, but I do agree with you though. Like, one of the things that I found really distracting is I remember watching the Pro Tour M15, and this is when Jared Becher was still Rookie of the Year, and he's Rookie of the Year, and he's at the Pro Tour, and Marshall Sutcliffe is interviewing him, and they're in these really comfortable looking leather chairs, and he's in these like really baggy shorts, and he has this dirty hoodie on, and he's like slouching in the chair. I can see up his shorts, and I just couldn't help but think, like, you're the Rookie of the Year, you're at the Pro Tour, and you look like you rolled out of bed. Like, when I personally go to a Grand Prix, I mean, mind you, it's just a Grand Prix, and I probably won't do very well, but I put on a good face. You know, I think about what happens if I end up on a feature match, and it was just surprising to me that somebody wouldn't have the same respect or reverence for, you know, you're at the Pro Tour, and Ben Stark in pajama pants, you know, and he's commentating. And I'm like, what are you doing? And I agree with you, right? And I'm not saying it has to be a suit necessarily. You know, you can see Reed Duke in a nice pair of jeans, and he has his nice Channel Fireball shirt on. And, you know, there's ways to look nice without going all the way. But I do feel like there's just a, you know, a disconnect there where it's like, and maybe it's because they do it so much that it's just second nature to them. But for us at home, like, it's the Pro Tour. Like, you know, if I knew I was going, I'd get my hair done and I'd look nice. And I just don't understand why others don't feel the same.
It feels like it's our responsibility to make it look nice.
Yeah.
But yeah. Not everyone feels the same. You know, this freedom of speech and freedom of doing whatever you want keeps them from doing a little making a little effort. Say, oh yeah, oh, I can do whatever I want. If I want to go to the PT in my jeans and my or in my shorts or in my pajamas, then I will do it. There's nobody to tell me what to do. So that it feels like the people who don't make efforts, that these are these people. But,
I think you also brought up a good point about being, you know, sort of, I hear Mark Rosewater say that we're ambassadors to the game. And that's something else I think about, too, is that my local game store that I play FNM at is not just a Magic store. It's inside of a mall. It sells board games. It sells card games. And we do get a lot of spectators who are just walking through the store. They see, you know, 20 tables of people, and they may walk back and see what you're doing. And, you know, I sometimes see the parents who will walk back there, and they will see some folks who maybe aren't dressed very well, and you can almost see their face sort of fall, where like they'll walk to the back of the store and they'll be like, oh, what's going on? Ew. And they just kind of, cringe. And it's like, I never want people to do that. Like, I want people to walk to the back of the store and see us playing magic and not want to, like, usher their children away. Like, come on, honey, there's scary people back there. I want them to see friendly faces and clean faces and not feel like we're dirty or like we're anything to avoid. And I hate that feeling. I hate seeing people, so excited about what we're doing and then just, ew. Like, no, I don't like that. No.
It's part. It's just gonna be very hard to change because it's probably part of the lifestyle kind of. Because to play cards, you don't really need anything. You just need to be there. You don't need to dress well. You don't need the people you're gonna meet. They don't care about your looks. They don't care if you like. It's gonna be pretty tough to say, but they don't care if you bathed, like if you showered or anything. Well, they will care if you're too like disgusting. But it's no. But it's true. Like it's. You don't need to do anything. You get there, you sit there, you have your deck, you play. You don't need any physical preparation. You don't need any grooming. You don't need anything. So that's part of the thing. And they don't want to make effort. Making efforts for Magic players in general, pretty lazy people.
Yeah.
So it's gonna be pretty tough to change that.
Well, I think it might also have to do with the lifestyle too, where it's like, especially some of these people who are on the grind, it's like, they're driving 5, 6 hours at least in the US to get to an event, and then they might get there and then they might stay up all night testing with friends, and then they get 3 hours of sleep and they chug a Red Bull and have a bag of Doritos for breakfast. They play 9 rounds of Magic or what have you. They're exhausted from doing that, so they probably crash right when they get back to the hotel. Then they make day two, so they get up early to do it all over again and play another 6 rounds. And so I can understand a little bit, the idea of who has time. Like, you're so busy, just go 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 go, and I can understand how that might fall to the wayside a little bit because you don't have time. You're so focused, you feel like you have other things that are more priority, but you could put a little more effort. I agree with you. So you were inducted into the Pro Tour Hall of Fame in 2006. Did you know that that was going to be your year?
I wasn't sure.
Yeah.
I knew that was a good chance, but I wasn't sure. And I was very happy when I got the email from, I think it was BDM who emailed me. Yeah, I was relieved, yeah.
Yeah. Felt pretty good.
It felt very good, yeah.
Yeah.
It was I was looking forward to that email.
One of the things that stood out about your nomination, I've noticed, is that you were incredibly active at the time you were inducted, and that you've continued to remain that way. And I've had a number of Hall of Famers on my show, and many of you have sort of settled down, if you will, where they're not really on the grind anymore, or they are focusing more on, other pursuits. But you're still chugging along. We still see you with the GPs. We still see you with the Pro Tours. Is there anything in particular that you still want to achieve in Magic that keeps you going?
Well, at some point, I'm gonna have to win something, like to win like PT or something. I have to top 8 again because it's kind of like running away from me every time. I do well. I do well. I'm always very close from top 8. I'm always top 32, top 25, top 20, but I never get to the top 8. That's my not downfall, but I've only like made 3 top 8s, 3 PT top 8s. Out of I don't know how many PTs, that's very, very bad average. So I'm gonna have to do better. I'm gonna have to work on that and improve on the, I don't know, on the matches I lose and I shouldn't lose. It's probably 1 or 2 matches every time that I lose and I shouldn't lose. And that's the difference between top 20 and top 8.
Do you think that if you achieve that, you finally reach that goal of winning a pro tour or what have you, is there a point where you say, okay, I'm a Hall of Famer, I've won a pro tour, I've done everything I want to do, or do you feel that you'd still keep going because you just love the game?
It was when I got back from Sweden. So I was considering like not playing the game anymore because I was like, okay, so now what now? So I'm back in France. What am I gonna do? I need to find a job. I need to find like something I can do to make like more money or to settle down and like have a normal life. And then I actually went to see a lot of people, like the professional to who help people to look for jobs, who look for career perspectives. And everything they were telling me, every time they told me, oh, you should do this, 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 and this, I just felt this this shivers down my spine. This shivers down my spine. Like, this is not at all what I want to do. I don't want to see these people. I don't want to go there. I don't want to do that. I want to do exactly what I'm doing that makes me happy. Well, so what makes me happy? Traveling around playing Magic. Okay. How can I make this a living? Well, I'm going to have to work a little bit on the side. So work, like write articles or do other stuff to make money. Oh, that can work. I can't do that. So I stopped feeling bad about playing for a long time. I felt bad about playing. I felt like, hey, I really should get it like a real job. Even though I was making enough money to pay my rent, to do everything I wanted to do and travel around. But I felt bad. And the day I felt, okay, enough bad feeling bad about it, just embrace it. Just live your life with it. And from then I lived very happy. Mm-hmm. This is what I want to do, and I'll continue to do it as long as it makes me happy.
Mm-hmm. Now, when you say that you felt bad about playing Magic, was there anything you were getting from like outside sources, or was that all you? You were making yourself feel bad?
Probably a little bit of both, because you know, some people say, oh yeah, well, you're always on holidays. You never work. That's, you know, you feel bad about this. Mm-hmm. You're like, oh, what are you doing? Oh, yeah, I'm just going away for a week. Oh, yeah, well, some people have to work, you know. Mm. It feels like, oh, yeah, well, so you're looking down on me. Like you're better than me. Now, how does that even happen? What did you do that I didn't do? Yeah. So it felt like, yeah, well, I have a lot of potential. Why don't I use it to a better cause, to better things? And then I felt, yeah, well, they're not better. I'm actually never on holidays. Like, I travel around, and this is kind of my work. Mm-hmm. So when I can settle down and do nothing for a day, well, that doesn't happen often. Yeah. Well, how am I on holidays then? Why do people say I'm on holidays? No, I'm actually working. Yeah. So yeah, that's gonna be my job. That's gonna be my work. And since then, I felt like, yeah, when people say that, I'm like, yeah, well, you don't understand what I'm doing then.
Yeah, that might be part of that image problem that we talked about, where people think that you're just sort of playing, it's just a game, and you're sitting down all day, and you're not really working. And I disagree. I think it's definitely work. You know, I hear about the level of prep that goes into these events, like when I had Brad Nelson on my show, and he was just, you know, running himself ragged for that Players Championship that he went to. And I think at one point he said he got emotional over it, where he, you know, he didn't know what he was going to do, and he was stressed. And you guys definitely work for that. And I have a lot of respect for what you do. I would never presume to say that you're not working.
Well, for people who don't know, it's much easier to say that. Mm-hmm. You know, because you don't, one of the things is that you don't wake up in the morning at 7. You don't wake up at 8. And for people to work from 9 to 5 or 8 to 5, it's very hard to imagine that people who have another job don't have to wake up at 8.
Yeah.
Or at 6 or 7. So that's part of the thing.
Yeah. So outside of Magic, I discovered that you have another hobby, Rafael Levy, Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu.
Yes.
And there's pictures of you in your little uniform. And how did you become interested in that, Jiu-Jitsu?
So it really first started when I was GP Vancouver. That was very long ago.
Okay.
And that was just a moment of clarity. So I'm on my own for a day. I'm just walking around on the, like in the park in Vancouver. And then I looked back at what I did in my life. And I said, okay, so what can you do? What can't you do? So, okay, you have some potential. You can do smart stuff. But what happens? You get into a fight. Your smarts are not going to get you out of a fight. Like, you don't know how to fight. You never fought anybody. You don't even know any moves. So I thought, okay, when I get back, I'm going to sign up to anything. Like, I'm going to sign up to, like, I was not really an athlete, or I was not really like a sportsman or anything. So I need to change that. So I thought, okay, I'm going to sign up for like karate classes. So I started karate back then, and I did that for like 2 or 3 years. I don't remember how long I trained. And then a friend of mine, you probably heard about him. He's a Matias Jorstedt.
Yeah.
Yeah, Pro Tour Yokohama winner in 2005, I think. Anyway, he's a very good friend of mine. And we talked about what I was doing, what he was doing. He was training Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu at the time. I said, oh, you should definitely train karate. It's crap, man. Like, BJJ is just so much better. You're going to have so much more fun. and I had no idea what it was at the time. Mm-hmm. So that was when I was visiting him in Sweden. And when I got back home, I was like, okay, I'm gonna try. I'm gonna see what that is. I didn't know anything about it. I didn't know what even I had to do. So just to let you know what it is, Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu is it's between a judo and wrestling.
Okay.
You're wearing a gi, a kimono.
Yeah.
And the point is to control your opponent on the ground, and eventually end up with him tapping out because of a choke, because of an armbar, of a knee bar, of a ankle lock, anything that would make him suffer very much if he didn't tap. So that's what it is. That's what the sport is. So I started and had no idea what was going on. I trained once, but after my first training, I went home and I wanted to like throw up for like the whole night. I couldn't sleep, and I was like, okay, so this is quite the thing. This is much more exhausting than karate. This is much more exhausting than anything I've ever done before. So I decided to sign up to the class. Okay. If you ever enjoy training, if you're ever good at this, you will have accomplished something. Mm-hmm. So I went back, and it was very tough in the first few trainings because I was not in shape at all. And it took me a while to understand how it worked, but once I understood, I got hooked, and now I train as often as I can. It's been very hard the last couple of months because. Well, maybe we'll talk about it later, but I got married and we traveled around a lot, and the PT, I've been a lot more into the preparation for the PTs. So it's been quite hard to train a lot, but when I can, when I'm at home, I try to train like 4 or 5 times a week.
Mm-hmm. Now, does jiu-jitsu have belts? Like, is there a degree of skill that you're at right now? Okay.
Yes. I'm still a blue belt. This is not the easy way up. Like, you know, when you hear, oh yeah, my nephew is a black belt in karate. Like, oh, my 10-year-old, my 10-year-old sister is a brown belt or a black belt. In Brazilian jiu-jitsu, it's much harder. Mm-hmm. Like, when you get a higher belt, you're supposed to know everything the lower belt knows. And in sparring, you're supposed to beat him. Mm-hmm. Like, it doesn't matter how much bigger he is. So that means they can't just give you a higher belt if you don't know your thing. And there are a lot of very good blue belts that are not close to him to being purple belt. Purple belt is the one after blue. Mm-hmm. And blue is after white. So it's just the second belt. But once you get to purple, it's another level again. So you have to beat most of the blue belts. It's a simplified version of things. Mm-hmm. But to get to a higher belt, it's a lot of work. It's a lot of dedication. You can't just go once a week and expect to have a better belt. If you're not good, if you're not in shape, if you don't train, if you don't do this, it's not a gift. You don't get gifts in that sport.
It's so interesting to me because you were telling me how you got the idea to do this, and it sounds very random. Like you're just walking around, you know, and you're like, huh. I can't defend myself. I'm going to go fix that. Like, I could see if you'd had something happen to you and you were like, man, I really got my butt kicked. I don't want that to ever happen again. But it's just interesting that, you know, one day it just dawns on you that this is something you haven't ever done. And do you have moments like that often where you're just going about your daily life and you're like, huh, I should do this or I should try this?
Well, not anymore, since that was pretty much the biggest revelation, like one of the biggest revelation, because it fixed a lot of things, like doing sports. Like I'm running, I'm training, I'm doing a lot of sports. That would change a lot of things in my life. I feel in shape, and every time I don't train for a couple of days, I feel bad. I feel bad because I feel my body needs it, and that's a feeling I'd never had before. I just felt a little sloppy. I tried not to eat too much, but not doing anything to be in shape. And being in shape is it brings you so much to your like to mental health.
Yeah.
And I think that's what a lot of players are missing. This okay, take an hour to go work out. Not even be hardcore about it. Just a little bit. Just go run. Just not be, be a little careful about what you eat. Be a little more careful about, your physical condition.
that's something that will like keep you going for years. If you just eat bad and do nothing like for too long, you can just end up like sloppy and lazy. And I don't like to be lazy. Being lazy is the biggest enemy of everybody.
Yeah. Do you think that, you know, the eating better and the staying in shape, that that helps your magic game?
I'm sure it does.
Yeah,
I'm sure it does. Because keeping focus is a very hard thing. And if you you just burn out, if you just do that and don't do anything else, there's it's probably by like it's chemistry, it's biological. If you don't do sports, then there's some hormones and stuff in your body that just don't work very well. Well, I'm not like I could explain that in details, but that's probably not. We probably don't have time for that.
I don't think it's that.
Huh?
No, it's not that at all. You can definitely talk about that.
Oh, no, it's got to be complicated.
Raphael Levy, nutritionist. No, I agree with you, though. And I think, again, it goes back to that lifestyle where it's like, you know, you're going to these convention centers that have these quickie concession stands that have pizza and nachos and chicken tenders and blooming onions. And Lord knows I love them, too. So there's nothing necessarily wrong with that. But, you know, if you are somebody who's on the grind and you're in that setting weekend after weekend, you know, you're living off of drive-thrus and concession stand foods and you're not really getting to a grocery store. You're not able to pick up a Clif Bar or pick up a bag of apples. You're just on that grind, and you know, Red Bull in the morning, like I said, and you know, it's you know, when you decide to slow down a little bit and incorporate those things into your life, you know, I do see people say it made my game better. You know, you see Brian Brown Duin and all of them, and I think that's great. I think that's something that more people need to try or talk about. So, and you also started your own magazine about jiu-jitsu called Jits.
Yes, so so I did that. Okay. So what happened was, a couple of years back, I went to Brazil with a couple of friends of mine. Mm-hmm. We went to train. We went for a month to Rio, and we went to train hardcore in Brazil. Like for a month, training three times a day, like once in the morning, once in the afternoon, once in the evening. And there I met, Canadians who were running a magazine in Canada, or in the States in Canada. In English. And at the time, you know, that was a little bit after I found my, I realized that it would just play magic and maybe try some other stuff, but I still had free time. Mm-hmm. And I said, yeah, well, you know, I can bring a magazine to France. I can do that. I also worked as a freelance translator. So I was like, yeah, I can translate that and, bring it to France. So, when we worked on the first issue, at first I thought, yeah, I'm just going to translate that. But the sport is quite new in France. It only appeared like 15 or 20 years ago. Mm-hmm. Like in the first people who trained in France, that was in 95. So pretty much when I started to play Magic. And the sport is pretty young. And people don't know each other. So I thought, yeah, well, maybe there's a space for that. There's room for, you know, making the sports known in France and making people know each other. Mm-hmm. So I left the translation part, I left it out, and I started to interview people in France, like the practitioners. And from then, the magazine is mostly about French practitioners, and it's pretty cool. I like doing that. It's a lot of work, but it's very cool.
So the last thing I want to talk about with you today is you said you got married in August of this year. I saw your wife. She's beautiful. You two are a beautiful couple. I saw your Facebook, and I also saw a picture of you, and you were posing shirtless on a balcony or a beach, and you were showing off the bod.
Okay.
Yeah. Well, you've been working out. I'm just saying it shows. So how do you manage? One thing I'm always really curious about is, you know, you're on the grind, you're doing the pro tour thing. How do you juggle a serious relationship, a marriage, with the demands of that lifestyle? How do you do it?
So first, to get to that point, that's a lot of work.
Yeah.
You have to find the right girl. So she was not close to me. She was in South Africa.
Yeah.
So I got to go get her like very far away. So she's a very special woman. It's a lot of understanding. Like she knows what I'm doing and she embraces it as well. Like that was part of the thing. Like She's coming with me to PTs. She's enjoying the traveling. She knows that I'm sometimes going to bed late because I'm gonna be playing or because I'm gonna be talking to some people in the US. So I'm not gonna be in bed at before like 2 in the morning. Oh, I'm gonna have to sleep in the morning because I was up late. But you need to make space for everything. Mm-hmm. Like, I have time for her when she needs me, and I have time for her, like, most of the time. And she knows when I need to work. Well, she has her own job, so that's cool too. Mm-hmm. And we work together as well. She's a graphic designer, so she's actually designing the magazine.
Oh, wow.
So we work on that together. So an experience we have together all the time, like every day. We work on the magazine, like a few days a week. And so that's something we're sharing. I don't want to share the magic thing with her, the actual playing, because it's.
Oh, she doesn't play?
She doesn't play. It's not a thing. She's not playing card games.
Okay.
But that's. I think it's better too, because you know this is my thing. She does her own things, and that's cool. So, you know, a casual or like a day in my normal day would be waking up, go train jiu-jitsu. Come back, work a little bit, spend some time with her, maybe work on the magazine with her, and like plan the next trip. That's pretty much what we do every day. Mm-hmm. So that's very special.
So it sounds like it's important that you know, even though you have something that you don't necessarily have in common, it's important that you have something that you do, where like you said, she doesn't play magic, but you have the magazine. So there's still that something that brings you together.
That's one of the things, yes.
Yeah. So I'm curious, though, how did you meet her? Because she's from South Africa and you're from France. So how did that happen?
So I actually met her very long ago. Okay. So when I was traveling around, like back in the days, well, for GPs and stuff, I was trying to find to meet people, you know, online. And so I could, like, go out and, I'll let you guess what it is.
Are you on Tinder, Ralph Levy? Was that what that was?
That was not in 2005. There was no Tinder.
You were swiping.
But then, you know, I got to meet a lot of people, and the site is actually it's called Communities. I think it still exists, but Facebook just killed it.
Okay.
It was just, you know, people from around the world talking to each other, and there was not a dating site. You know, it's you have people of all ages and from around the world.
Sure.
So we got to talk. I don't know what occasion we talked, but that was never really a thing. You know, she was in South Africa. I was in France. I was traveling in Europe. There was no way I was going there. But you know, one day, she decided to come to Europe to visit me. And like do a little tour, and it happened. That was like 4 or 5 years after we actually met online. Mm-hmm. And since then we traveled back and forth to South Africa, to France, and now we got married, and she moved to France. Mm-hmm. So that's the big adventure, a long distance relationship for a long time. That was very hard.
Yeah.
But you know, when you get to find a special someone, doesn't really matter.
Mm-hmm. And what does she think of Ralph Levy, Hall of Famer, pro player, the fame that comes along with it? Is she amused by it all?
Oh, she's proud.
Yeah.
She's proud. Like, I remember when in 2007, that was one that was after I got into the Hall of Fame, and I won the two GPs, Dallas and Singapore. After I won Dallas, I was talking to her at the time. Like, oh, I want this GP, look at this. And she was like, oh, wow, that's awesome. And I told her, okay, I'm going to Singapore next weekend. If I win, I'll buy your ticket to come to visit me. You're coming to France to visit me. And she's like, yeah, sure, whatever. So we went there. I went there. I won. I told her, well, look, I won. Now you have to come. She's like, yeah, but you know, that's not going to happen. And, she didn't think it was actually possible. And she didn't think I would actually like pay for it. I was actually like more up for it. But then, well, eventually like 5 or 6 or 7 years later, I did buy her a ticket to come to France. So all in all, it did happen much later, but so is she amused? No, she's not. I mean, she's just proud and she's happy to hang around and see my name, and she's, see that she's in the good company.
Mm-hmm. Well, you sound happy when you talk about her. I can tell that you two are crazy in love, and it's a beautiful thing. And I like hearing you talk about it. So that's awesome.
Oh yeah, I'm very happy.
Well, thank you so much for coming on the show, Raph. It has been a pleasure getting to know you, and I hope I get to run into you somewhere. I know there's a Pro Tour happening in my home city this year in October, so if you have any plans to go to Pro Tour Milwaukee, it'd be nice to meet you and to run into you.
I will be in Milwaukee.
Oh my God, I get to meet Raph Levy. That'd be awesome. So if anybody's enjoyed listening to you on the show, Raph, how can they find you? How can they get a hold of you?
So I'm on Twitter on at Ahamud, H-A-H-A-M-O-U-D. Mm-hmm. And I have a Twitch, but I've not been very good at streaming lately because I've been doing so many things. But you can find me. It's Raphael Levy, I think, in one word, on Twitch. And on Facebook, Raphael.Levy.MTG.
Mm-hmm. Are you still writing for TCG Player?
I am still writing for TCG. I'm not writing bi-weekly. Mm-hmm. I used to write like whenever I had things to say, but now I'm writing bi-weekly. Mm-hmm. I got a little bit more involved.
What does your Twitter name stand for? I'm curious about that.
It's just look at try to figure it out. If you figure it out, just let me know.
Oh man, you got a little riddle for me here. I have to say that last article you wrote an article about a dredge loam duck.
Mm-hmm.
Oh my goodness, my followers ate that up. I posted it on Twitter just really casually. I was like, oh my God, this deck looks like so much fun. And normally my followers can be, or my friends can be a little snarky, and they're like, oh Aaron, this deck is never going to go anywhere. And I just assumed that it was going to be a fun deck and nobody would really think anything of it. And I got a number of responses that were like, you know, this deck could be onto something. It just needs a little something. It's almost there. And
I'm working on it.
Yeah. Yeah, that was a deck where I saw it and I was like, I'm in. It has all the things I love. It has gen colors. It has graveyard interactions. I'm sold. So you will definitely have to keep us posted on that deck because I look forward to it being something. So.
All right.
And thanks again for coming on the show.
You're welcome, and thank you for welcoming me.
Absolutely. And if anybody's enjoyed what they've heard here on the Deck Tees, you can always find the show first and foremost on GatheringMagic.com. The show is on iTunes and Stitcher Radio. Please subscribe and leave me a review and some stars. You can keep up with the show on Twitter at the Deck Tees. You can keep up with me at Original Estrus. And you can email the show at thedecktees@gmail.com. Thank you all so much for listening, and please take care of yourselves, okay?
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye.